This is the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, Series 5, Episode 24. Eye patches, not just for pirates. Coming up on this week's Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, we talk about vision training, how it all links in eye patches and how that helps with late performers. And we talk about what happens if you are a left-arm spinner and you gain weight and start bowling full tusses. Oh no, what's the answer to that? Find out all that and more on this week's Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. It's time again for the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, your guide to coaching and playing better cricket. My name's David Hinchliffe, and you might hear a little bit more of a croak in my voice this week because we're recording at a slightly different time, slightly earlier in the morning, so I'm still rubbing my eyes and drinking my coffee. And joining me in this early morning session is the regulars. It's Director of Cricket Coaching at Millfield School. It's Mark Garraway. Morning, Garrers.
Good morning to you.
And it's the cricket professional at Portsmouth Grammar School, Sam Lavery. Hello, Lavers. How are you doing? Are you awake yet?
Yeah, very well. Thank you, David.
And of course, people will be listening to this any time in the day. It'd be strange if you listening to this at 10 o'clock at night thinking, what are they talking about? But it is very early in the morning. Hopefully, you're enjoying the husky voices. We had a message this week come in from our friend Wolf. You remember Wolf? He's always coming up with ideas for slightly unusual questions. And famously, of course, turned down winning a prize, the online coaching course prize from Pitch Vision Academy, which goes down in the annals of history as the only person to ever turn it down to pass it on to somebody else. So selfless to the last, Wolf has come up with another question which I thought was worth discussing, and he's brought two concepts together which I've never brought together in my head before. I don't know what you chaps think about this. He was saying that he wanted to know how you balance the differences between process and outcome, which is two terms which have worked their way into the game in recent years. Now, when you talk about process and outcome, you normally talk about, say, coaching methods, where you talk about, you know, the difference between getting a wicket, which is the outcome, and working on your bowling action to bowl a line and length, which gets the ball to be nicked to the wicketkeeper, which is the process. But in Wolf's question, he was looking specifically at team tactics, and he was saying, as an example, to win, you need to risk losing. So, Garrers, when it comes to process, outcome, team tactics, and in order to win, you need to risk losing, where do you stand on these things?
Well, on the last one, I think there are situations where you do need to risk losing in order to win. And particularly as the game gets longer, I think there's more opportunity for you to take some risks in terms of some of your decision making, you know, declarations being probably the classic, yeah. Aren't they? The most important one, which doesn't always come into play within club and school cricket nowadays because so much of it is limited overs. But certainly in the higher levels of a game and in the grade cricket and club cricket in South Africa and New Zealand and Australia and various other places, declarations do come into play quite a lot. And certainly I've been part of a couple of games where I've been sort of the one that made the decision about when we declared. And there was one great example where we set Derbyshire a total on the last day, which was eminently gettable. And then they didn't go for it because they hadn't actually won in a year and a half or 2 years or something in the championship. And they didn't go for it. So at tea time, I took our part-time spinner outside their change room and he just bowled to me into a mitt. And all of a sudden, we saw a flurry of activity with different people getting their pads on and stuff in the corner of my eye through my sunglasses and realised that they'd taken the bait a little bit. And it ended up with they needed seven off of the last over. And third ball, they decided to try and get back for two on a tight one. As soon as the fielder picked it up, I knew that we were winning the game. And the bails got whipped off, and that was that. So there was an example there of taking a risk by setting what was a low score. And I had a few players in the changing room who said to me, what on earth are you doing? We've got no chance of winning this. But you do have to do that occasionally. Yeah, I suppose in the shorter format of a game, some of the risks that you take might be bringing on a bowler to a spinner to get the ball up in the air to see if you can create a wicket opportunity. And whilst that doesn't happen too much in 50 over and 2020 cricket, we do see it sometimes, particularly when people are up against it a little bit and they need to buy a wicket. It does happen every now and again. And there's been a couple of games in the T20 Blast this year where part-time bowlers have come on and taken a vital wicket and opened up an end again.
So, Lavers, how do you find that that ties into process and outcome? Is that something that ties in the way that Wolf has asked in his question?
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. I think the process that people think about and is ever-changing, though. And I think within a game of cricket, the process that we're looking to go through to take a wicket, for instance, or to win a game, some people, you immediately think of the process being a more... a long-term solution or a long-term plan to achieving something, whereas something outcome-based is more short-term. But obviously the process is, at any given stage, what we're looking to try and work through to achieve something. So it's very flexible and it changes all the time. It's difficult to separate the two sometimes, and at the same time they become the same thing sometimes. So it's a good area of conversation that Wolf's brought up, as always. But I try as much as possible to keep guys working through processes to achieve outcomes. As I said before, I think we've got to keep being aware that the process changes. I remember we often work through the process of building pressure. So rather than looking for the outcome of taking a wicket with the ball, we go through the process of building pressure. And sometimes you have to, as you mentioned, risk losing a game to win a game. And sometimes we have to scrap the plan of building pressure. We have to say, actually, we've just got to try and take a wicket right now. And we've got to put all our eggs in one basket and risk losing everything in this over to win a game in six overs time or five overs time. We've got to give them the chance to score 15 or 20 runs off this over to take two, three wickets so we can win something in half an hour's time. So it's a really interesting subject area, and obviously it can be applied to all sorts of different parts of the game, whether it is technical or tactical or mental or training processes. There's lots of different areas you can apply process and outcome to. So it's an endless subject area to talk about for me.
Yeah, it's great stuff, and I've mentioned it from time to time because it's still on my bookshelf, on my decreasing in size bookshelf, because the more and more books that I get on Kindle, the less and less physical books that I have. But I still keep a few books because I do like proper books as well. And one of them, which it would probably be the last one I ever threw away, would be a book called How to Win at Cricket by E.M. Rose. You ever come across that one, chaps?
Never.
It's incredible. It's a guy who played club cricket for years and years and years in the southeast of England, and you know, in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And the book was written in the mid 80s. And he's written a whole book basically on the nuts and bolts of captaincy. So if you imagine Mike Brearley's The Art of Captaincy, but written from the perspective of someone who has played club cricket rather than been Mike Brearley, knows that game inside out. There's so, I would say probably 90% of that is still applicable to cricket nowadays.
I'm sure. That's a good tip off.
If you can find it, I mean, it's long out of print, but if you can find a copy of that, I regularly reread it, put it that way. It's just one of those that's so inspiring, and you'll always pick another tactic or tip from it that just, if you just open it at any page, there'll be something on there and you go, oh yes, of course, how could I forget about that one? So it's well written and highly recommended if you can ever find it. Right, let's wrap up with the yes no round. Three questions that we can only answer yes or no to, no matter how much more that we want to say. And I'll be in charge of reading the questions this week. And if, gentlemen, you can give me your yes or no, here we go. First question, club cricket's main priority should be youth development.
No.
No.
Second question, the spirit of cricket has a bias towards batsmen.
No.
No.
Third question, it's crucial to quietly zip up your bag at the end of a podcast.
Absolutely, yes.
Yes, unfortunately.
Okay, let's delve into the mailbag this week. We have a couple of questions, as we do every week, and we answer those, and the best question of the week wins a prize, which is an online coaching course courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. If you want to send in your question to us, you can do so by emailing coach@pitchvision.com, and we've got lots of other ways you can get in touch with us, and we'll tell you about those at the end of the show. But let's get these questions underway for this week, and the first one is from Randy Singh. Hello, Randy. And Randy says, I recently read an article about eyesight and how you can train your eye muscles to improve performance in a number of sports. I was wondering if this had a direct correlation with late performers in cricket based upon their hand-eye coordination peaking slightly later. Also, have you come across any cricket-related techniques for training the eye muscles? So that's a good one. We've talked about eye training before, and I think there was a general kind of thumbs down from the panel on it. Or maybe healthy skepticism, let's say. But we've never looked at it from the angle of how that relates to when you peak in your talent, if you like, and some people become better at cricket later than others. So what do we think? Is there a relationship between training your eyes and when you become a better performer?
Can I go for...
Yeah, you can go first, mate.
Fire can on. I go for no?
Oh, good. Interesting. And why do you say no? I'm interested in, go on, what's behind that?
I'm going to back that up by also saying I'm not 100% sure, but my research around this area, which I've done a little bit over the last few months, and I did a little bit last year at one point as well, is that the ability to up-train the muscles that work the eyes and then allow them to detrain themselves is an extremely quick process due to the size of the muscles, is the generic response I got from a lot of the research that I looked at, which means you can develop them quite quickly over a matter of 3 or 4 sessions. Yet if you skip a week or 2 weeks of doing these eye exercises, then they detrain themselves again. So it's something you've got to be doing constantly. So I don't, given that, that doesn't suggest to me that it's something to do with a phase of development thing. However, running alongside that, I would also say that simply by watching a ball, that is an eye training exercise. So simply by batting, you are training your eyes. And the more batting you do, the better you will get. So as you develop more, as you face more balls, your eyes will improve. That's the main gist that I've picked up over the last couple of years, that the speed at which they can be developed and can be untrained as well suggests to me that development times of people probably wouldn't have a massive impact on it. Gareth is probably going to blow me out of the water with that one, though.
Well, I'm not. And the reason being is that I don't have any massive amounts of experience in relation to this specific question on it. So I'm like you, Sam. I can't really comment against the actual question. I'd be really intrigued if an expert, somebody like Dr. Cheryl Kohler, for example, could possibly be in a position to answer that question with a little bit more certainty than either you or myself can on it. I mean, in terms of eye training, I think Sam's hit the nail on the head there, in that you can train up very quickly and get benefits from it, and also you can detrain very quickly. And the Ireland cricket team before 2007 World Cup worked with Cheryl and were convinced that that was part of their success going forward into the World Cup and getting through to the second phase of a competition. They thought it was a really massive part of the reasons why they were there. Now, you can look at that from two points of view, really. One is the sort of psychosomatic and the pseudo effect that has, and also the actual effect too. And they were working very closely with her on computer screens tracking balls going across the screens and various different things, and definitely came back with a strong view that it was a positive. So the trouble is that that's blimmin' expensive for people to do, and it's probably out of the reach of anybody other than international cricket teams. So that's the reason why I was a bit cold on it when the previous question came in, was just purely because I understand the economics that sit behind it. But going on from Sam's point around watching a ball, we are training all the time doing that. And the other thing that I found quite useful recently is if you get an eye patch, you know, just one from Boots or from a chemist, or other chemists are available, obviously, you get an eye patch from them, which people wear when they've had something in their eye, or they've got some sort, they want to keep the light out of their eye. Then you can actually start to bat, bowl, catch, and do all sorts of things with those on, obviously in a fairly closed environment. You start training your eyes slightly differently, because they automatically, as Sam said, start to work harder if you've had one of your eyes cut off from the field of play and the field of vision. So that's another thing that you can do. And what we do know now is that one of the eyes on each of us tracks motion better than the other one, and more efficiently than the other one. So one of the things that we can do is to build up the strength and the competency of the other eye by blocking off that motor eye. And by doing that, we find that we often make some technical adaptations which allow us to be successful when things get difficult. So I'm a big fan of eye patch batting and eye patch catching, because it makes the body adapt. And ultimately, in a game of cricket, we're not always going to be able to do what we do at our most efficient and our most preferred way. We're going to get people spinning the ball big. We're going to get a pitch that goes up and down. We're going to get a match situation, which is really, really tough. And difficult for us to cope in, and ultimately we have to adapt, and our eyes play a very crucial role in that. So if we train with eye patches on, particularly over our motor eye, our more effective eye, then we start to build in our ability to adapt to different situations and different techniques.
So that method of using an eye patch sort of overcomes the problem of when you do eye training, which is not cricket specific. It's the specific adaptation concept, isn't it, where you are, if the adaptation happens outside of a cricket environment, then how much does that cross over into a cricket environment? If you're actually doing cricket things, then you're going to have much more of a crossover.
You are. And also, you know, the great thing about the eye patch is whether you make it yourself or whether you buy one from a chemist, is really cheap. And and it's fun, because what people find is when they stick an eye patch on, it feels incredibly weird, particularly when you put it over the eye that generally tracks movement for you. So for me, it's my left eye. I'd cover my left eye, and then my body has to adapt significantly in order to be able to do quite fundamental skills, catching a ball. Hitting an off drive at 60 miles an hour becomes quite difficult, and then our body adapts, and our non-motor eye has to strengthen itself and has to become dominant at that stage, which is a fascinating process. And certainly one that I'd encourage people to have a go at, and you know, start off by maybe using softer balls, particularly when you're catching, because you know, it will feel weird, and you will start hitting the fingers in different places initially before your body starts to adapt. And the other thing that it does as well is it teaches the body how to relax even when you're in an uncomfortable situation, because initially you'll be tense because you're not used to it, and then over time your body will adapt to it, and all of a sudden you'll start to relax a little bit more and find that even though you're not at your most optimal, because you haven't got both eyes looking down the pitch or watching the ball come into a catch or watching the ball come into a hit, you'll find that your body adapts, and you can start to do things which, although they're uncomfortable, actually feel as if you can cope with them.
So Lavers, now bearing that new piece of information in mind for you, how would you tie that into later developers? Do you think maybe that kind of training would help a later developer improve more quickly?
Potentially, I think it'll help anyone really. Whether or not you'd specifically target as a late developer or not, I don't see why you wouldn't apply it to everyone with a certain degree in their program throughout a year. One of the things I was going to add there is it's a brilliant tool for coaches just to almost double your little book of drills, to be honest, because everything that you're doing at the moment, you can pretty much then reproduce under stressed conditions such as that. And suddenly your winter, where you maybe find yourself dragging and you get 7-8 weeks into your winter program and you're already looking for things to do potentially, or you're already thinking that you've covered certain things, you can then retrace them, upgrade the intensity level or the stress levels by testing the eyesight there, and suddenly a drill that they've been there and already done to death already with some success becomes a new exciting drill. As Gareth said, they are often quite enjoyable and interesting for you to see how they react in terms of their eyesight, but also how they react under the pressure or under the scenario of something they're not comfortable with. So always good to see how your players react in that situation. Again, judging it against early and late developers, I think it's something that we'd have to look into more and see if we can do a bit more research around it and hopefully come up with an answer next week, maybe.
Oh, I think it might take a bit longer than a week, Sam, that one. I mean, it's a really, really specific question, isn't it? Which I love. Yeah. I think it's fantastic. And it would, and the answer is, I don't know. But somebody like a Cheryl Calder would have a much better idea. And it might even been something that she's done. But looking, you know, while she's been talking there, I've been flicking through the internet trying to find a direct link. And there doesn't appear to be anything at all, let alone anything that I can say is concrete. So, fascinating question, brilliant. And but I'm sorry I can't give you any more than that, and hopefully I've given you a couple of drills that you can use which don't cost very much, as Sam says, can freshen things up as well as have a really practical application.
Let's go for there's no specific evidence and no specific research, but let's go for gut instinct. If you were to say, my gut tells me, I don't know whether it's right or not, but my gut tells me, I don't know why it tells me this, but my gut tells me, would you say that there's a place for eye training when it comes to someone who's a later developer? Yes or no?
I couldn't see it to it being any harm.
Yeah.
I could say nothing more than that. I could say it's not going to do any harm whatsoever. I like the idea of eye training, particularly in a practical and inexpensive fashion.
It may be one of those things that a late developer can use potentially just to try and catch up on those around him who maybe aren't doing that sort of thing. Because you've got to look if you're behind. You've got to look for not corners you can cut, but little ways you can just edge back into the and join the pack and join everyone else. And ultimately, it means doing things that other people aren't doing, whether it's training more or training differently or training more smartly. And it may be one thing that you can tag onto your training routine that just brings you back into the pack and hopefully gets you on a level playing field with everyone else.
Right, let's move on. Thank you, Randy. Next question is from Ganesh. And Ganesh says, respected coach, I'm a left-arm orthodox bowler and recently I've put on some weight. So now, most of my flighted balls have turned into loose full tosses. Is there any way I can solve this? Can you tell me the correct body weight for a left-arm orthodox bowler? I'm 17 years old, 170 centimetres and 80 kilograms. I need advice, sir, on how to make my bowling better and the diet that I need to follow. So another unusual one. It's a week of unusual questions. He's a left-arm spinner. He's got a bit chubby and he feels like that's affecting his bowling. How can we help him?
It did say respected coach, so I knew it was aimed at me. the first thing I'd do is probably strip back that question a little bit, and there's a few things that we can kind of discount to a degree. I know that he wants us to say you need to be, he's 80 kilos at the moment, he probably would love for us to say, actually, if you're that tall and you're 17, you need to be 74 kilos, and it gives an immediate target. That's obviously not the way it's going to be. There are left arm spinners of all different shapes and sizes, and you can immediately throw out Suleiman Ben and Samit Patel. There's two international cricketers. There is no set size or shape that you need to be to bowl left arm spin. However, if this relationship between him putting on weight and him losing a bit of control and bowling full tosses is true. Let's investigate why that could be. Well, obviously, with a little bit more size, you may find that his mobility has changed slightly. And perhaps I've seen it happen with a couple of cricketers before. They fail to complete their action and rotate quite as well as they maybe had done in their younger, slightly slimmer days. But as a result of that, they may find that they're not getting the same action on the ball, which isn't getting the same over-rotation or dip on the ball. And that may be something that's happening and maybe something we can identify. However, this is still very much guesswork because we haven't seen his before and after footage. So this is something that we're guessing on to a degree. But what I'd like him to try and think about doing is just try and consider, is there anything different in his action, either in the starting position or the finishing position, or the pace that he's approaching the crease? Is there anything that he thinks is notably different in his action? And if there is, focus on that first of all, because it may be something as simple as you've got through a certain stage in your career and you're forgetting to do something very, very simple because you've bowled and bowled and bowled and you maybe haven't considered the technical side of your game at all. If there is, it might be something that you can't counter without potentially losing weight. Whether or not that's the case, I probably would doubt initially, but it might be that losing weight does help and you're looking in the right area. But yeah, as always, it'd be great to have a little bit more possibly video footage of it, which would be a great thing to have alongside the question. But I would say there's no strict answer in terms of the weight you're looking to bowl. But you may be right. You may have hit the nail on the head in that the weight is the answer, but that's not definitely going to be the answer, I'm afraid.
Well, I think I think the question's quite revealing, and Sam's gone over the weight bit. But to me, you're 17 years old, and left-arm spinners or any spinners for that matter are quite a long way off of reaching their maturity in terms of being able to complete their action on a consistent basis, hitting line and length, and doing all the things with the ball that you want to do. You've only got to look at the history of spinners to know that actually it's a patient game being a spinner. And whilst we can have success in our early years, we've also got to accept that we only peak around the age of 25, 26 and beyond, and most spinners are at their best into their 30s. So it's very much a waiting game on that one. And I think every spinner that you speak to who's ended up being world class has gone through a phase where, you know, that their flight changes because their body shape has changed. And in your heart, you're talking about weight there, but I'm also thinking about the height change that you've had and the limb length change that you've had over the last couple of years as you've gone into peak height velocity and maybe even now beyond that. So there's a lot of changes that have gone on height wise, and that's going to have an impact on your ability to hit the lengths that maybe you did when you were 14, 15 and before you started to grow extensively. So I'm going to go at it not from a weight point of view, but just for the fact that you're 17 years old and there's been a lot of body changes in terms of your limb lengths. The second thing is, and this is to build a little bit on what Sam talked about. In the last couple of weeks, I've watched a lot of a bloke called Haraf, and Haraf's a bit of a throwback to me, the left-arm spinner for Sri Lanka. He's a little bit of a throwback in that he bowls a bit like somebody in the 1960s and 1970s when, on black and white TV and all of that, but he bowls beautifully. He runs up, he keeps a very repeatable action. He's quite a mature cricketer now. He's been around a long time. But he doesn't really do what the new bowlers do, which is run up chest on. He gets overly sideways on. He gets the seam rotating in different fashions with a very, very good awareness of release position. And he caused the England batters in both tests heck of a lot of problems. So he's certainly not what we would call a cricket athlete. But he's somebody who knows his skills inside out. He's a mature cricketer. He's gone through that stage where you're at, where his limb lengths have changed. He's got used to his actions again. He's been really patient, and now he's getting his rewards. So just don't try and do it too quickly. It will come to you. Be patient, and you'll be fine.
So with that context in mind of saying it's not a there's not a direct correlation between being a little bit of a fatty and not being able to bowl very well. If it's still a concern, then there are some simple things you can do to lose a bit of weight. One of those would be to find some other activity other than cricket that gets your, you know, that gets your interest and gets your heart rate going and gets you running around and doing things. And that can be whatever is of interest to you. I mean, you know, anything from playing hockey to going to the gym, what, you know, anything that gets you moving is going to help with that, burn those extra calories. And a great piece of advice that I heard recently about diet, which is fantastic, I think, because it's such an easy piece of advice to pass on, which is cook your own food. Cook your own food from scratch. And you will very quickly learn how to cook healthy. And automatically, your meals will be healthier than if you're, you know, getting a takeaway or having someone make food for you, because you've got that in mind right from the start. So if you're in a position where you can make your own meals, even if you don't know how to do it, learn how to do it, then that's going to help you if you've got any if you've got any concerns over your weight and whether that's going to help with your fitness in cricket. So I think that's a nice piece of advice. Just cook your own meals.
Well, you know what's going into it then, don't you? That's the difference, and you can make a choice. You know, as you're concocting your different meal, then you can just choose whether you put in this or that, or take away a bit of that, and you're in charge of that, and that's all we're ever looking for.
And I think that's a massively important skill just for life. You know, the ability to be able to cook is, you don't have to be a gourmet chef, but if you can cook a few meals from scratch, then you're going to be healthier, you're going to be fitter just purely from that, and you don't even need to do anything else.
It's soapbox time on the show, and here's David to rant and rave. You got a minute, mate?
Recently, we've had some discussions at my local cricket club about the amount that people contribute to coaching the younger players in the club. We've got a lot of players who play and they have their game of cricket and they go away and they don't contribute to the youth section, which leads it up to a couple of dedicated people to do a lot of the work, which is fine, you know, that's not a problem, but it'd be nice to see more of the senior players participating. So one idea that we came up with was, instead of getting someone to become a coach and commit to coaching 1, 2, 3 times a week, we have someone who acts as a mentor to a specific young player, or 2 or 3 young players who can, they can come along, they can have a masterclass from someone with a lot of experience in the game, in the club game, and they can hopefully get a little bit more of a tie to a senior player. So when that senior player finds out that the player is doing a little bit better because of the advice they give, they get a bit more involved, and maybe they come to a few more games, and it helps everybody in the club. And that is the end of the show for this week. Before we leave, we do need to decide on the winner of this week's competition, of course, which is an online coaching course, courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. So we had 2 questions, one from Randy Singh about the correlation between eye training and late performers in cricket, and the other one from Ganesh about his weight and his bowling. So which one did you prefer this week, Gareth?
I'm going to go with Randy Singh's question this week, because we couldn't really give a definitive answer on it, but hopefully we came up with a couple of good ideas that you can use with your plays to develop develop eyesight, and also to put them under a little bit of pressure in a fun fashion. So I'm going to go with that one.
Marvellous. Congratulations to you and anyone who's listening to this show who isn't Randy Singh, and they want to have their question winner prize, which is the online coaching course from Pitch Vision Academy, then they can send in their question to us. Now, Gareth, how would somebody do that if they felt the need?
Well, they could give us a call on 0203 239 7543 or drop us an email at coach@pitchvision.com.
That's right. We also are on Twitter at Pitch Vision Acad. We're on Facebook, facebook.com/pitchvisionacademy. And you can get us in all of those ways if you like. Now, if you want to listen to this show, you prefer to consume the wise words of the panel, then you can go to iTunes and subscribe there. Just do a search for Pitch Vision Academy. If you don't want to use iTunes, you can use any other podcatcher. You can search for us in any podcatcher that you have, or you can go to pitchvision.com/academy, click on the podcast link, and you'll see the instructions for the RSS feed, which you can throw anywhere that catches those podcasts. That's all for this week. We hope you listen next week. But until then, have a good week. Cheers, Gareth. Cheers, Lavers.
Cheers, fellas.